live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. You can watch this program by going to Ustream channel, then searching for Gary Null. You can also listen to our program on any portable listening device. I was just given the number that between 40 and 50,000 minutes every day. So that's a lot of people listening because they're out and about. That number, write it down, 712-775-6850, 712-775-6850. People are tuning on every day, and we thank you for doing that. Why? Because they have different needs. We have a lot of young people listening. The average age of this radio audience is 37, college-educated female. We have older people, of course, and even teenagers. Some people like health and nutrition, and today I'm going to share a study from the University of California at San Francisco about how reducing sugar in unhealthy kids brings rapid improvement. This was a very novel study, and I commend them for their creativity in that. I'll share that with you. Also, for those parents in this audience, we do have some who have children who've been diagnosed with ADD and ADHD or autism. I've suggested a lot of different things for your protocol, like methylated B12, methylated folic acid, B-complex, reestablishing healthy gut flora with probiotics four times a day, and also glycerophosphorylcholine for the brain, phosphatidylserine, R-alpha-lipoic acid. These really help. I'm going to add another one today, so get your pencil and papers ready for that. Then also today, I'm going to take a look at whether or not inflammation causes you to gain weight, even if you're not overeating. From Lori Shimmick, PhD, the issue is, are we overweight because we're overeating, or are we overweight because we are eating pro-inflammatory foods? Also, working up a sweat can protect men from lethal prostate cancer, University of California, also San Francisco. The guest in the second part of my program talking about our obsession with the future and its consequences for the condition in the present is Hal Nijshevicki. He is a Canadian journalist, author, social critic, highly regarded for his astute perceptions in deconstructing the illusions of the high-tech industry and popular fads and contemporary lifestyles and its many promises that were sold, but it doesn't work. For years, his research has focused upon the future possibilities that drive companies and technologies and different philosophies. He's the publisher of Broken Pencil, a leading underground publication devoted to subcultures. His articles appeared in the New York Times, Utley Reader, the British Globe, and others. So we're going to have an interesting conversation. Time permitting today, I'm also going to take a look at our economy, because I can't tell you how many people listen because bankers listen. In fact, the head of a bank in Florida listens every day. And a lot of people who are concerned about the future of our economy tune in because I try to get you ahead of the curve on issues. Today, just how bad unemployment really is. Everyone should pay attention because you've been lied to. When I share the actual numbers, and these are government numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you'll say, wow, then why were we told we only have 5.3% unemployment? Because possibly the government didn't want it to be as bad as it otherwise would have been had they told you the truth. Also, the war on cash. How and why the financial elites want to end physical cash. And I'll share the latest on that. And along with that, from Ellen Brown, a piece about money in the bank, not the best place to keep it. Quote, hang on to your wallets, negative interest, the war on cash, and the $10 trillion bail-in. What does it mean? Well, it means you should consider the value of keeping your money in their bank versus putting it in to a safer place that won't engage in a bail-in, which means that if there's a financial crisis again, which there will be, we're in one now, they could confiscate literally every penny you have, everything. You'd never see a nickel back. Think not? Wait to hear what Professor Brown has to say. Also, for environmentalists, I found this interesting because I'm a person that supports clearly and unequivocally the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, human rights, and landowner rights. I'm opposed to the notion that the government should have the right to tell you what to do with your property, providing you're not doing anything that adversely impacts the environment, animals, or other human beings. So what's the government doing now? Well, according to Waking Times, Philip Schneider, the government is criminalizing rainwater collection in an all-out war on those who want to be self-sufficient. Well, that's not very cool. After all, think of how many people are wanting to get off the grid in part or whole, by themselves or with others, because they want a better quality of life. They want to return to a more minimalist way of living instead of collecting stuff that they don't need. And now the government's saying, you can't do that. For example, you can't put a trailer on your own property and live in it. Well, hold on, I thought. People did that. People did. People also used to have cisterns. In fact, recently when I went to a film festival where I was, one of my films won an important award in Bermuda, I spent the day, it's a small little island, you can drive from one end to the other in about 15 minutes, and it's not very wide, but every single house I saw had a cistern. So then I went into the basement, and they have these big holding tanks. They get their water that way. But there are other places to get their water that way also. Can't do it in most states now. Which states? Why can't you? If it's raining outside, and you go out and collect water from any source, let's say you use a barrel or a cistern on your house, so the water hits the roof, rolls into the gutter, goes down into a tube, goes into a storage tank in your basement or outside, you could be put in jail. You could be fined. You can't do it anymore. How'd they do that? Well, they did it, like they do a lot of things, because too many people are not paying attention. So, also today, if time permits, I was listening to some chatter from people who are using the Bible as a literal interpretation of their reality. Okay. I'm not going to take the 471 specific references I have that could challenge that anything is a historical, actual fact. And this is for all the Ben Carson advocates and the others on the right who believe in the literalist interpretation. It's your right to have that interpretation. But we're going to give you a little history lesson today of how often your Bible has changed and no one told you about it. So you're quoting things that have nothing to do with Christianity. Nothing. And you'll hear what it is when I play it. Also, something that is not said when it comes to France, setting aside the terror that happened, the extraordinary suffering that the French people and the victims went through, why does no one ever focus upon what France does militarily, or what they did in Algeria, how many people suffered, how many were tortured, how many were killed? But I'm not even going to go to Algeria. That's easy. That's low-hanging fruit. I'm going to Haiti, or what is better known as Hispaniola, which is an island that's mainly made up of the Dominican Republic on one side, the larger side, and the smaller side, Haiti. I want to show you what the people of France did as official policy to the poor people of Haiti for over 100 years that kept them in virtual debt poverty. So we have a lot to share today. Let's begin. First up, reducing sugar. Now, this audience knows the dangers of sugar, even in small quantities. In fact, it was about 15 years ago when I was upgrading the article, which I do about every 3 months, on sweet suicide, the sugar in our diet. And I've been upgrading this for over 35 years, so it's always new material. And it's there with 700 other articles I've written on my website. I found a study that showed that for every 100 grams, that's a small amount, that's 3 ounces, that's a small amount. That's not even the amount that's in a small soft drink. You would actually have double that in a small soft drink. But that's enough to suspend one part of your immune system by almost 50% for 6 hours. So let's just put it in perspective. Let's say that you're a person with lupus, arthritis, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and you had a soft drink like that, your immune system is going to be put on hold, making you more susceptible to an infection, because your immune system is what protects you from microorganisms in the environment. Now imagine all the people in hospital who die of infections. In 1 year, it was over 80,000 that they contracted from being inside the hospital, their immune system, because the food in hospitals is just an abomination. So here's what the university, I'll quote verbatim from the University of California at San Francisco, quote, "The now proven false claim that saturated fat causes heart health issues caused many to switch to low or no fat diet for decades. Naturally, children were affected also, and the obesity rates climbed as a result. The problem is that low fat foods contain higher amounts of added sugar and high fructose corn syrup to make them more palatable after removing wholesome fats." Now, along with high carbonate craze, TV commercials got kids to insist on cereals with lots of added sugar and high fructose corn syrup. Families also indulge in microwave oven prepared quick sugary breakfast foods and processed foods for other meals also promoted on TV. The result has been disastrous for a multitude of ills based on metabolic disorders that introduce type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular problems, increasing despite the low or no fat craze, which is only now slowly beginning to fade as more discoveries reveal how saturated fat are actually healthy. By the way, that's, as an aside, that's true when it comes to coconut fat. That is not true when it comes to arachidonic animal fats, but because it's pro-inflammatory. And then it goes on to say, then a Dr. Robert Lustig, University of California, San Francisco, professor of pediatric endocrinology, came up with a study to further prove the culprits behind our rising epidemic of obesity, prediabetes, diabetes, and even heart disease is not dietary fat, but added dietary sugar and high fructose corn syrup. By the way, on that I would agree with him. Dr. Lustig, that's L-U-S-T-I-G, has dedicated himself to long-term epidemiological and biological studies as part of his crusade against the enormous increase of added sugars in our foods and sodas with the correlation to increasing obesity, metabolic disorders, and poor heart health. This was published in Sugar, the Bitter Truth a couple of years ago, and it was dynamically captivating enough to hold many people's attention despite its length. Don't confuse whole fruit fructose with commercial corn syrup fructose or high fructose corn syrup. The latter is artificially synthesized and highly condensed fructose that gives more sweetness and flavoring to processed foods at lower cost than cane or beet sugars. Besides being produced from GMO corn with its absorbed glyphosate levels, traces of mercury are carried over from the manufacturing processes. The researchers decided to use children who were obese and experiencing metabolic disorder, meaning they were pre-diabetic. The two often go hand in hand. Minority children were selected as subjects because their metabolic disorder obesity profiles are very high. The study's purpose was to determine whether isocaloric, meaning equal calorie, substitution of starch for sugar would improve metabolic parameters in Latino and African American children with obesity and metabolic syndrome, ages 8 through 18, with the average age 13. No attempt was made to change the essential dietary habits of the children. Foods provided were purchased from nearby regular supermarkets. Their processed and junk food levels remained the same. The only difference was the sugar content. And then what they did, and I won't quote any more of it, what they did is they gave the sugar that would normally be in a starchy food, which the body takes time digesting and has fiber, like an apple, and versus the same amount, identical amount of sugar from an apple, but is high fructose corn syrup. So calorically, they're the same. But what a difference in the body. And the results show that they lowered the blood pressure, they had lowered weight, they had better glucose levels. Now, what's important is that this is a study that only changed one single food. They still ate pastas, pizzas, breads, and the bulk of the standard American diet. But still, which is changing the high fructose corn syrup and giving them a starchy substitute, that's all. There was, quote, isocaloric fructose restriction improved surrogate metabolic parameters in children with obesity and metabolic syndrome, irrespective of weight change. So what's the takeaway message from this? Because this is really very important. Let's go back to my days as a dietitian in dietetic school. And one day I asked the professor, I said, I see on this list that you told us we could give a patient in a hospital, you did not distinguish the type of calorie. If it was a fat, it could come from any source, including lard. If it was sugar, come from any source. I said, wouldn't it be better if we gave a wholesome fruit, like an apple or grapes or an orange, and at the same amount of caloric input as refined sugar? And the answer was, no, it's all the same. And I said, but it can't be the same, because in the apple you have enzymes, phytonutrients, you have quercetin, you have fiber, you have all these wonderful nutrients a body can use. And the professor argued that, no, they were identical. Well, that professor was wrong, but almost all dietetic teaching has been wrong. Now, I'm a registered, certified, state board dietitian. I'm also a state board certified registered clinical nutritionist. I also have a PhD in clinical nutrition and human nutrition and public health science. So it's not as I'm saying this without some academic and scientific background, but I can assure you that the entire medical community is wrong. The entire scientific community is wrong. The entire dietetic community is wrong. If they believe that a calorie is a calorie and it is irrespective of the source, it doesn't matter what the source is. That's like saying an amino acid is an amino acid, the building blocks protein. So if you want, let's say, 30 grams of protein from meat, it's one forkful, by the way, one fork. But if I wanted to get the same 30 grams protein, I could have a cup of soybeans. The soybeans just give me isoflavones, fiber, B complex, nutrients, and amino acids that are non-toxic if they're organic. The meat is giving me no fiber, is giving me heterocyclic amines, which are known carcinogens, is very difficult to digest, and the fat is a saturated fat that is pro-inflammatory. And yet, we have been telling people wrongly, and not innocently in that wrongness, we were telling him with malice aforethought, because if we told people you don't ever have to eat anything that comes from a creature, ever again, you don't have to drink their milk and shouldn't, it can lead to osteoporosis and allergies, you don't have to eat any hamburger, hot dogs, you don't have to eat any fish or chicken or veal, nothing. You can get all your nutrients and live a longer and healthier life if you're a healthy vegan. That would impact about a $300 billion a year industry. Do you really think anyone's going to allow you to impact their industry without a big pushback? The answer is no. But then again, if you stop the argument, well, an amino acid is amino acid. So it doesn't matter. If you get it from meat, if you get it from, you know, soybeans or baked potato, it's all the same. It is not the same. Not by a long shot. Anyhow, I would go ahead and do research at the Institute of Applied Biology showing that if you took kids off a diet that had sugar and put them on a sugar-free diet, but even that, I did another study where I put them on low glycemic sugar. Like, have you ever used monk sugar, M-O-N-K? Haven't? Read up on it. It's better than coconut sugar. And comes from the monk fruit, where all they do is just take out the sap and they dry it. That's it. Low glycemic, but it adds a sweetness. And stevia, sweet, low calorie. Even maple syrup or maple sugar, which is organic syrup that is dried without high heat and therefore doesn't rush the blood up. These are still preferable over high fructose corn syrup. And you'll see a difference in kids. In fact, in one prison system where they took out the sugar and dairy, the acts of violence reduced themselves so radically that it caused a whole national debate within the scientific community. Dr. Schoenthaler and Dr. Alexander Schaus led that study. Yet today, we have prisons that are full with nothing but junk food. And by the way, for the people who are incarcerated today, listening around the world, in fact, a lot of you communicate with me. I always answer my communication and provide always the best substitutes we can have. And I think it would be terrific if we had an advocacy to get rid of the food that people are eating and give them actually healthy food. You would see healthier persons in incarceration, and you would see less violence because the science is already there to prove it. You know, but they only took one item out. They left all the other junk food in, and still there was this enormous benefit. Now, why is that important? Because when I do a study, and by the way, just as an example, I'm going to read a study that is complete, ready to go out for peer review publication and scientific review. It was done earlier this year, and it had remarkable improvements in blood pressure, blood sugar, pain, depression. But can I tell you any given item that worked? No, I cannot. Because to be on that protocol, you had to change everything. So on the one hand, I can show that major changes cause major improvement. But if someone argues, well, how do you know that this worked? I couldn't say I know that because I haven't done mono studies. This is a mono study. All the other junk food they continued eating, it was just one single substitution and made that remarkable improvement. So that's a good study. Now, could you imagine they took those same young people and completely put them onto a healthy plant-based diet with supplements, then do another study? Next up, from the Brain Bioresearch Center, for those of you who have children diagnosed with ADD and ADHD or autism spectrum disorder, there was a great scientist. He was just a remarkable human being. His name was Dr. Carl Pfeiffer, who's an MD, PhD, and he published, along with a Dr. Osman, the first double-blind placebo-controlled study of a nutrient in schizophrenia with remarkable benefits. But he also did some work with DMAE and found that it had an enormous benefit. In fact, quote, DMAE, that's all you have to know, you can go into any health food store and get it, was found to result in enhanced behavior in 2/3 of the boys and 3/4 of the girls. Hyperactivity was greatly lessened as attention span was lengthened. Irritability was decreased. Scholastic ability improved. And in some cases, IQ was elevated. How about that? Another double-blind study supplemented 74 children who had learning disorders. Many were hyperactive with 500 milligrams of DMAE for 3 months. They were then tested for behavior, reaction time, and put through a series of standard psychometric parameters. There was not only general improvement, but also performance improvement in children with learning and behavioral disorders. While DMAE, taken internally, can help with mental focus, DMAE applied externally found that topical applications for 16 weeks was, quote, safe and efficacious in the mitigation of forehead lines and wrinkles and improved lip shape. Interesting. This was a separate study. I just found it important on this. Also, finally, from Sun Yat-sen University in China, vitamin E improves bone density for women. And this was 3,000 women in the study. It was published in the British Journal of Nutrition. Quote, our study adds to the evidence that supports a positive association of vitamin E in diet with higher bone mineral density and a lower risk of osteoporosis in a large sample of middle-aged and elderly Chinese women. So, I would suggest taking between 400 to 800 units in the morning and always take with tocotrienols and in the evening about an hour before you go to bed because you want that vitamin E working in your blood overnight. And Dr. Lori Shimek found that inflammation can cause, and this is both acute inflammation, can cause weight gain. Now, I've believed this for a long time. I'm glad they actually had this study, which means that when you are overweight, your body's massively inflamed. So what you need to do is you need to go on a anti-inflammatory diet. Get rid of all dairy, meat, get rid of all fried foods, processed carbohydrates, refined sugars, artificial sweeteners, caffeine, alcohol, carbonated beverages, and go towards a alkalizing, meaning plant-based diet with lots of green juices. You turn off inflammation and you lose weight. So now we know when you're having the sodas, not only is it adding sugar, it's adding inflammation. And that can cause a problem. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. Now I want to shift into this because I found this important. I'll quote this verbatim. This is from Philip Schneider of Waking Times. It's posted on our website. Quote, and by the way, we just got the latest figures, and if I'm wrong on the figures, our program director, Jason, will come in and tell me, but I believe that the articles that we post all day, and even at night, I hired someone to post articles overnight, plus documentaries and film clips, 225 million, almost a quarter of a billion people came just in the last 12 months to download them. So we keep loading them up, and these are from all over the world. Here's what he says. And this article is also posted called Government Criminalizing Rainwater Collection and All War on Self-Sufficiency. Quote, collecting rainwater is classically seen as a safe and sustainable way of supplying your household with an off-the-grid water supply. Some people collect rainwater only for a backup reservoir, while others prefer to go all the way and maintain their household with pure, off-the-grid rainwater collection. This method ensures water during emergencies, can help control floods, saves money, and liberates us from company dependency for our water. Consequently, this freedom to collect our own rainwater is currently under attack. State laws have been set up in several U.S. states, including Oregon, Utah, California, Florida, Colorado, and Washington, that prohibit the collection of, quote, diversion, end quote, of rainwater, including water that is falling on your own property and is to be used for your own private use or as an environmental conservation technique. This idea of state-owned rainwater is opposed by many environmentalists on the left and on the right and libertarians and constitutionalists and even historical figures such as Chief Seattle when he said during his 1854 oration to the European colonists, quote, how can you own the rain? Supporters are mainly governments and privatizing companies who tend to lean towards ideologies that sacrifice individual liberties. Now, though it seems common sense that the water that falls on your own property would, of course, belong to you, state governments increasingly challenge the idea with legislation demanding that your water does not belong to you. It belongs to them. And if you want to use their water on your land, then you first have to obtain a water right. And if you are denied this right, the water that falls on your property, even if you need it, will be illegal to use. You'll be thrown in jail or fined for the use of that water. You are now a water criminal. And then he gives some examples of this. So just want to let you know that if you care about your rights, you should state that and let your legislators at the state level know that water rights are your rights. Any water that's on your property is yours. If it rains and you collect it, it's yours. You shouldn't be criminalized and fined. Just yesterday I read in the paper about how all these portable vending trucks are going out of business. And I actually met with a group of people who wanted my ideas on could they work together and do one of these. And it was a great idea. I told them I'd give them menus and tell them which items people are most likely to buy. They wanted to do a vegan cart with having soup, salads, desserts, sandwiches, juices, fresh and organic daily, vegan, organic, and kosher. I thought, great idea. And one person had the truck, another person was a chef, another person was a baker, another person had a business background. So it was a perfect coalition, bringing people together to work together. Remember what I said, the future is we, not me, working together for common goals and with people who are emotionally and creatively in alignment. And everything was a go. And then I said, but before you do this, your problem is not getting your cart ready or menu ready or having the best locations to be at and getting it's your permit. And remember, I'm not aware of any place in New York City, for example, where you can park without getting a ticket. And those tickets can add up. And therefore, if you got 3 tickets in a day or 4 tickets a day, you've just wiped out your profit for the day. And they said, well, surely with all these people, I said, don't look at the trucks are out there because you don't know how many fines they have and you don't know the hassle they're going through. All you know is you see a vegetarian truck with a long line of people wanting to go to it, or a Tex-Mex truck with Mexican food with long lines of people. And you see them in Manhattan in the boroughs. Now you don't. They're all going out of business, or a lot of them are going out of business. Why? Because the city stopped issuing new permits based upon the number that they allotted a long time ago, like in the 1980s, and then they make it impossible to get through their bureaucracy. And so now people who had good ideas or good businesses are, one guy had, I think, $5,000 $6,000 in tickets, because the moment you park, there's going to be someone giving you a ticket. They come back an hour later, you're still there, they're going to give you another ticket. So how in the world can you survive? If you had a government that actually cared about you, I forgot we're in New York City, a cesspool of corruption, New York State. New York State is without question the most corrupt state government in America. I thought New Jersey was. They could do an arm wrestling match and probably be equal. Pure, fetid corruption, cronyism, and we're seeing that now based upon some little karma justice, but a tiny amount of karmic justice. The two of the most vile people in the history of New York are actually on trial, and hopefully they'll go to prison. But then if you put everyone who had ever been corrupt at the local government and city councils or a legislative body, you would have a very empty local and national government. You want to go into business like this, go to a state that at least allows you not to be dealt with in such a draconian way. Go to where they don't have the zoning issues. My top choice would be in all of America, of all 50 states, there's no question, hands down, it's Texas. Even for water collection, you're not going to get hassled. Water on your land is your land, and it's written into the laws. So if you think you can run the gauntlet in New York, imagine what you're going to have to go up against. And I don't want to see people with good ideas waste those ideas. Go to a state that actually respects people with imagination, good ideas, and is not looking just to exploit them, just wring every nickel out of them, as they do in New York. And if you doubt me, be a small business person in New York and see what kind of cooperation or understanding you get from your landlord. They own the laws, rent laws in New York State. Not every place in New York they do. So, just about the water, but it's also about where you're going to live. Better check your zoning. And just how bad unemployment is today compared to the Great Depression. Here's the statistics you should know. This is according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Right now, as I speak, we have 94.6 million Americans, 16 or over, are either not working, can't find any work, or have made no effort to work, or were working and stopped working. Now, we have about 321 million people. That means that nearly one in three people in the United States are currently out of work. And that's from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Okay? So, when they tell us that we have, 5.1% unemployment, that's not true. We actually have about a 24% unemployment rate. And therefore, we're in a recession now, but they're not looking at the people who are in the recession. If you live in Manhattan, if you live in, some really nice areas of America, you'd never know that there's any problems. This is from Global Research, the War on Cash, How and Why the Financial Elites Want to End Physical Cash. Quote, in recent months, the Securities and Exchange Commission and other regulators have implemented legislation allowing money market funds to lock in your cash for up to 10 days during the next financial crisis, meaning you cannot get your money out. The FDIC has implemented legislation permitting it to seize, quote, systematically important banks and convert their deposits into equity. And that's called the bail-in. Remember that was used in Cyprus 2 years ago, where $100 billion of people's savings was gone? Government took it. JP Morgan and other large banks have begun rejecting large deposits. France has banned any transaction over 1,000 euros from using physical cash. Spain has already banned transactions over 2,500 euros. Uruguay has banned transactions over 5,000, and so on. There's a widespread global campaign to eradicate physical cash. And we now got a connected insider confirming it. Dr. Harold Malgren is about as connected as you can get in Washington, D.C.'s political elite. He served as a senior aide to four separate presidents, as well as a senior aide to the Senate Committee on Finance. This is someone who knows what global elites are thinking about the financial system and U.S. economy. Here's what he said recently in an interview to Sinclair and Company, quote, banks in the United States and Europe are trying to develop a cashless transaction system. The concept is to establish a comprehensive ledger for a business or a person that records every single thing they receive or spend and all their assets held, mortgages, investment portfolios, debts, contractual financial obligations, and anything else of market value, including pleasure boats, automobiles, anything and everything that they own, the government would then know. Governments would very much like such a ledger to exist because they could view everything that is taking place financially in real time, including the ability to evaluate net worth, patterns of spending, of earning, and unearned income, and of course an instant assessment of all taxable activities, end quote. So that's serious. And it's not some dream. They're doing it. Blythe Masters, the J.P. Morgan architect of organized market trading of modern asset-backed securities like mortgages-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations, is leading the business effort to develop a universal cashless system. Not only is she gathering significant investor interest, but the Federal Reserve and various U.S. government agencies have become keenly interested in the potential usefulness and efficiencies of a universal cashless system. So, why am I opposed to a cashless society? Okay, let's say you're an activist. We know now that 17 different governmental agencies have a file on you. You may have just not ever showed up for any march, but you may have signed a petition because there was some social injustice, human rights injustice, animal injustice somewhere. You're on their list. If you've actually shown up for events, you're at the top of their list. If you're a leader of any movement that challenges corporate interests and profits or political system, you're on the top of their list. So now imagine that there's about, let's just say there's about 16 million of us. We, the people who've actually stood up or been concerned enough to voice some support for legislation or like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now let's say we have a cashless society and they decide to punish you. Well, they can stop you from buying anything. They can stop you from spending anything. They could lock in and freeze every single thing you do. You literally couldn't travel. You couldn't do anything because you wouldn't have any cash to do it. I do not trust anything about our government. It is a fascistic police state government. Anyone who thinks otherwise is extraordinarily naive. And but that's, you know, that's what's happening right now. So, and not only that, but according to Professor Ellen Brown, it's worse. Quote from Professor Ellen Brown, Web of Debt, hang on to your wallets, negative interest, the war on cash, and the $10 trillion bail-in. And it goes on to talk about four European central banks, European Central Bank, the Swiss National Bank, Sweden's Riksbank, and Denmark's National Bank, have now imposed negative interest rates on the reserves they hold for commercial banks, and discussion has turned to whether it's time to pass those costs on to consumers. The Bank of Japan, the Federal Reserve, are still zero interest rate policy, but several Fed officials have also begun calling for negative rates. The stated justification for this move is to stimulate demand by forcing consumers to withdraw their money and go shopping with it. When an economy is struggling, as it's its standard practice for a central bank to cut interest rates, making savings less attractive. This is supposed to boost spending and kickstart an economic recovery. That is in theory, but it doesn't work in reality. So their next step. So historically, if you had savings in the bank, you would earn up to 6%. Then when we started into rough times, it was down to 2%. Now it's zero. Now they want to make it negative. So just listen to this. They want to be able to take your money and take money from you. So if you have $1,000 in a savings account and they want to take 2% negative interest, they're going to take 2% of that for themselves. And then you're going to say, gee whiz, I'm losing money. I better go buy something. How asinine. I suggest you take every penny you have out of every bank and put it into the non-commercial banks. Do your homework. They're not all equal. And like the Bank of North Dakota. Or load up on silver's very low. Gold is artificially suppressed. You'll see this when we really get into a jam, and protect your assets. But now they got a bail-in that's now there, so they can take your money, and they would, and they want to pay you no interest, but to actually charge you for putting your money. Then why would you want your money in their institution if they're charging you for the right to put it in their institution? That is just insane. So remember, you've been warned, it's coming. I'm Gary Knoll. One final thing before we go to our guest who's on standby. I asked people from one of our sister stations that I wanted to try to help them if they would send me information about premiums they didn't receive, and I would try to make every effort to get them their premiums. I'm in the process of doing that, and tomorrow I will share with you a letter that I wrote to the head of Pacifica, as well as read to and sent to the people at the station in New York, positive ways to raise money for the station. And by the way, it'll be good for all the other non-commercial stations that listen to this program, because these ideas are universal, meaning any non-commercial station anywhere in America would benefit from the information I'm going to share. That'll be on tomorrow's program, so please listen in. And I've already sent the letter out offering three ways, three very positive ways, that they could raise lots of money, pay off all their premium, outstanding premiums, and get those out the door to you, the listener. Okay? And hopefully they will heed that advice. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. Let's go over and say hello to my guest standing by. He is up in Toronto, Canada. His name is Hal, and let me spell his name for you. NIEDZVIECKI. Nice to have you with us, Hal.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
I gave you a bio a little earlier in the program at the introduction of it, so I'm going to go right to the issue at hand, and that is I'd like for you to focus on how our information age, and in particular high technology, has led to private industry's obsession with the future because it generates huge amounts of wealth for companies. And if you have information about the future, you have something to sell. And today, all large mega corporations, investment banks, and governments are highly invested in gathering information and data about the future. And as you point out, the average person probably reflects on the future every 16 minutes, albeit ever so briefly. Yet there's reflecting upon the future due to fear and how a person will survive or have enough to feed the family tomorrow, which is based upon basic survival instincts. And then there's the fantasy future, which today has become a lucrative industry, a product to sell. So please go through each of these obsessions, and we're also obsessed. Well, we're obsessed with the idea that we want someone or something to always be there to tell us what to do, what to buy, what to think, who to vote for. And people have also been mining our psychological behavior for a long time, our buying habits, our habits as human beings, so that they could commodify it. The forum is yours.
Thanks, Gary. There's a lot there to talk about. When I say that we are, as a society, obsessed with the future, I do mean this literally, of course. It's not metaphoric in any way. So the first thing to kind of touch on is that we really have this concrete obsession with the idea that there will be a future manifested in technology that will be kind of this great utopian technological future. And 3 out of 5 Americans, so about 60%, and this is a quote from a Pew Research Center Smithsonian survey done last year, quote, feel that technological advancements will lead to a future in which people's lives are mostly better. So that's kind of obsession number one, the idea that we have an ongoing ascendant technological upgrade that will eventually make our lives better. Obsession number two is the idea that we can actually know the future, and this is something that individuals, private individuals, believe, and it's something that government and big corporations are kind of pushing forward with this, that there's some way in which we can actually harness all the kind of data points of what has happened before to reveal what is going to happen in the future. And this, you know, this looks, there's a bunch of different looks at this, how this appears in our society. But one of them is obviously the corporate that you touched on, where we just have massive data gathering right now. So if you are driving around in your car using your GPS and you have your cell phone on and you are using your Visa card, you are just leaving this massive data trail. And then when you go through a toll, on a toll road, that leaves more trail. And basically every transaction, every movement can be and is recorded. It may not be traced directly back to you, but it is connected to a zip code, address, different ways to categorize where the kind of person that you are would go on a certain day. So this becomes kind of tremendously granular, where you just have a company like a Starbucks will hire data researchers to tell them where they should be putting a new store based on the traffic patterns, weather patterns, what has happened in the past to reveal what will happen in the future, and this is literally trillions of data points. And then, once this new store is set up, it may be possible to note individuals who will take a certain road on a certain day, at a certain time of day, in a certain kind of weather, and on and on and on. So basically they'll say, okay, we know where you are going to be tomorrow, so tonight we're going to send you a coupon for a free muffin to try to influence your behavior and really alter the future based on what we know about your past. And then, of course, this has all kinds of implications for law enforcement and security as well. Examples that I talk about in the book are examples where they will literally take data points of where crime has happened in the past and are able to predict where they think it's going to happen in the future. This is called predictive policing, and the implementation of this, there's been various claims about it, its efficacy and how crime has been reduced. They're also using it to actually target individuals, pull them in based on data and say, look, you know, based on the data we have of your past activities, we believe that, you know, you were likely to commit a violent crime, and so we're pulling you in to try to intervene before this happens. So we're starting to get into kind of Minority Report territory here, Philip K. Dick action. So, you know, again, there's just this tremendous, tremendous obsession with knowing what's going to happen before it happens. And then in the academic side, there are these giant studies, one of the most prominent being led by Philip Tetlock, who's in the Philadelphia area, I believe, and Dr. Tetlock has put this whole study in motion in cooperation with other universities and the U.S. government to try to figure out who can be a super forecaster. What are the criteria needed for people to be accurate forecasters of the future? And sort of by getting tens of thousands of people to answer questions about what's going to happen in the future and winnowing down those who are most accurate, and then looking at kind of what they have that others don't. And again, it's concrete. It's really the idea that we can, will, and should know the future. So, you know, there's a lot going on in our obsession with the future, and it all comes down and back to how we envision technology creating a utopia that foresees all of our needs, does all the work for us, and solves all of our problems. And massive data collection is just sort of one aspect of this, but right now in our society it is by far the most prominent way that we're trying to configure technology to foresee what we're going to need and what our problems are going to be.
Thank you for that overview, Hal. There is a huge problem that I foresee. Corporations have been heavily invested in gaining information in order to predict future trends that you just mentioned and events for decades. And in many respects, none of this has made the average human life better. I think the billions of dollars that have been invested in discovering genes for a multitude of diseases and health conditions, and there are almost no real cures or therapies that have been resulted from all this genetic information and investment. On the other hand, what it has done to strengthen a reductionist, determinist view of health and illness that pharmaceutical companies and the entire medical complex have capitalized on and serve as a weapon to oppose alternative and natural therapies as it competes with. So the mind can imagine an infinite number of promises futurists will make and opportunities they will have to capitalize upon them, and there is still the capitalist myth of infinite progress, infinite growth, infinite resources, and a religious belief that more innovation and gadgetry will increase revenues and improve working conditions in people's lives. Then where is the evidence for this? I do not see it. We have been on a constant downward slope with more poverty, poor health, increasing inequality for a long time. And when private industry becomes so obsessed with the future and their belief that their products and services are going to make the future brighter, they completely lose perspective of the here and now and other futurist trends that don't generate wealth but predict doom and gloom. What is there to give us any other element except what I see is a global economic collapse? What if the water resources are completely depleted in a region that relies upon agriculture? What if climate change and global warming become more of a reality in everyone's lives, where there's no longer any comfort in holding the denialism? And then what use are all these technological innovations for the future and new technologies nobody will be able to afford? So isn't this obsession with the future and capitalist innovation really just an industry to sell false promises? Your final thoughts.
I totally agree with that. I mean, I think it is a tremendous kind of shell game that we're playing, where we have a lot of problems in our society right now, and the answer is to use technology to kind of push those problems forward another decade or so and say, well, we'll solve those. The solutions to those problems are going to be technological, and they'll be coming along shortly. In the meantime, here is a new iPad, and it's got an even bigger screen. The idea that technology is going to solve our problems and generate wealth and cure all illnesses, there is some evidence to suggest that technology has made inroads in certain regards. I mean, we are certainly living longer lives than any other human beings that have ever walked the earth, and we are probably doing so in greater comfort. But at the same time, I think we're doing so in a way that sacrifices what will be available to future generations. So we're probably in the last couple of generations that can live in this way, after which there's going to be a precipitous decline in living standards that we are currently doing our best to ignore by throwing, you know, technologies out there. I mean, my favorite example of this is the Tesla luxury SUV. The Elon Musk run electronic car company, and when they released this $132,000 vehicle, Elon Musk was going on about it, and he said, this car is so amazing, quote, it is a car from the future. And you think to yourself, okay, well, if the future is going to be the electric luxury SUV, then we don't have much of a future at all.
I would agree with that. And also, I have to ask, where's the morality of people who constantly exploit others based upon promises? Look, we were told that we had absolute proof of a gene that would be predictive of a person dying of cancer. As a result, tens of thousands of women with completely healthy breasts and their daughters with completely healthy breasts went through medical mutilization with radical mastectomies. Angelina Jolie went through two, one having her uterus removed and the other having her breast removed. She didn't have uterine cancer and she didn't have breast cancer. She had merely a gene that was not 100% predictive. And even if it were, lifestyle can change the gene expression. And yet, that became the poster person for thousands of other people saying, well, I want to check up too. That's how you exploit the future and exploit people's fears. And I think it's unfortunate. More to be read on this in, by the way, Hal has a really wonderful book that he's written. And also his book is The Peep Diaries, P-E-E-P, which became a documentary aired by the Canadian Broadcasting Company more recently, Trees on Mars, An Obsession with the Future. So, and thank you very much, Hal, for being with us. And the website is alongcametomorrow.com.
Thank you, Gary.
All the best. From Toronto, Canada, that is Hal Nijavecki. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.